Welcome to Let's Talk New Mexico. I'm Megan Kamrick. The federal government must finalize a new plan for recovering the endangered Mexican gray wolf this year. The draft has come under intense criticism. Environmentalists and wolf advocates are concerned it doesn't promote enough genetic diversity and designates a habitat range that's too small. Many ranchers are concerned about wolves killing their livestock. Today on Let's Talk New Mexico, wolves in the Southwest. Why are they important to our ecosystem? How many should there be in the wild? How can we ensure the coexistence of wolves with other land uses? Call now, 277-5866, or email letstalk@kunm.org. Joining us is Sherry Barrett, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Services Coordinator for the Mexican Gray Wolf Program. Thank you for joining us, Sherry.
Good morning, Megan. Thanks for having me.
Sherry, this plan is supposed to update a plan from 1982, a court-mandated deadline for its completion of November 30th this year, following lawsuits by environmental groups. So what are the goals of this draft recovery plan?
The goals of a recovery plan, they provide guidance to agencies on what's the blueprint for how to recover a Mexican wolf, any endangered species or threatened species. And so the goals of this one are to find how many populations we need, how many wolves, and also importantly for the Mexican wolf is how do we address the genetics of the Mexican wolf.
And is it legally binding?
It is not. It's not a regulatory document. It is a policy document. It provides guidance to the Fish and Wildlife Service in particular, but also our partner agencies and any other entities that are participating in the recovery of the Mexican wolf.
So the plan calls right now, the draft calls for boosting the number of wolves to 320 in New Mexico and Arizona and to 170 in Mexico. How did the Fish and Wildlife Service determine that those are the optimal numbers for recovery?
Well, what we did was we actually had some previous recovery teams that were in effect, had science groups on them. They started and developed a what's it called, a vortex model. It's a population viability analysis that assesses different recovery scenarios to see if it will result in recovery. And for the Mexican wolf, what we were looking for was a population that had a persistence, a 90% persistence over 100 years.
And what's a 90% persistence mean?
Means that it'll be that we will still have Mexican wolves in 100 years.
Oh, okay.
And we have the 90% probability of that. And so we started with that model that the other science team developed, and we actually were able to improve it with new data. The previous recovery team was using data through 2008. And we took that model and included data on the Mexican wolf up through 2015. And we also were able to replace some of the data that they used where they didn't have it for the Mexican wolf. They used northern gray wolf data because a lot of wolf information is comparable. So with that, we were able to exchange some of that northern gray wolf data with Mexican wolf data. And we were also able to incorporate the captive breeding population into that model as well. So based on that, it looks at data, for example, like litter size and number of pups born, mortality, catastrophic issues that may occur. And so you put in all that information and you can see how it performs. You'd like 1,000 iterations and you can see how that population will perform over time.
So last year, New Mexico sued your agency to block the release of wolves, and an appeals court removed that obstacle earlier this year. But the state claimed the Fish and Wildlife Service didn't have a sound plan for recovery. How does this draft address that issue?
Well, what the state of New Mexico was looking for was a recovery plan. And so the draft recovery plan that we have developed, we worked alongside with the state agencies in the development of this recovery plan. And so the state of New Mexico did confirm that they approved the recovery plan as it's drafted. Of course, they're going to save that their final determination until we put out that final recovery plan.
Yeah, as you say, the New Mexico Game Commission recently voted in favor of this plan. We did reach out to the New Mexico Game and Fish Department, which implements the decisions of the Game Commission, to include them in this conversation. They did not make anyone available to participate today. So, Sherry, what kind of public input went into the plan?
Well, we put out the draft recovery plan first for peer review. Well, excuse me, let me back up. We actually put out the science behind the recovery plan for peer review in May, received feedback from 5 peer reviewers. We then put it out for public comment at the end of June for 60 days. At the same time, we put the recovery plan back out for peer review. So it's gone through 2 peer reviews. And during that time that it was out for public comment, we held 4 public information meetings, 2 in Arizona and 2 in New Mexico. And then we've been talking with partner and tribal agencies along the way as well. So it's had a lot of public comment. We received over 100,000 public comments on the draft plan, and we're currently going through those comments now, as well as the peer review comments.
Wow, 100,000. Okay, well, thank you for taking time to come with us today. You obviously are busy right now. Also joining us is Mike Phillips. He's director of the Turner Endangered Species Fund, which is based in Montana, but it has a captive breeding project here in New Mexico for Mexican wolves called the Ladder Ranch Project. Thanks for joining us, Mike.
Sure, Megan. It's my privilege, and I would point out to your listeners, I've also been on every Mexican wolf recovery team that's been convened since 1995.
I was just about to say that, Mike, and introduce.
had the good fortune to lead the Red Wolf restoration effort in the southeast, and then also led initially the restoration of gray wolves to Yellowstone National Park and the Greater Yellowstone ecosystem. So I don't know much, but I know a little bit about wolf recovery.
Well, Mike, you and fellow biologists supplied recommendations to the Fish and Wildlife Service in 2012 for an earlier draft plan. So what do you want to see in the final plan?
Well, Megan, please understand there's been a great deal more work done than just what was presented in 2012. As I said, I had been on other recovery teams, and we presented initial recommendations well before that to other very capable recovery teams, and largely all pointing out that we didn't see there was any practical way for the Mexican wolf to be recovered in a manner that fit the spirit and intent of the Endangered Species Act without establishing a Mexican wolf recovery region that went north into some outstanding habitat in southwestern Colorado, for example. So my short take on the draft plan is that it simply is impractical. The modeling that Sherry spoke to, she did a beautiful job. That's all very accurate. But the models are all built the same way. You put in assumptions and you get an answer. I would have you believe that the vortex model that speaks to 90% probability of persistence over an extended period of time may well be right if the populations can be established. And right now, the Fish and Wildlife Service would have you believe that there needs to be a population of 320 wolves in southern Arizona and southern New Mexico, and then 170 in Mexico. I believe, based on very good science, that those numbers across those landscapes are simply not achievable.
So we need more wolves?
Is that what wolves on the ground, you're not going to have recovery.
We need more wolves, is that what you're saying?
No, not necessarily. I'm not necessarily bothered by a grand total of 490. I'm just not sure that 320 and 170 can be situated in southern Arizona and southern New Mexico, the 320 and the 170 in Mexico. I don't think those habitats are sufficiently suitable for the Mexican wolf to get that many animals on the ground.
Why not?
I think that the big problem, at least in Mexico, is that there's entirely too much private land and an unknown number of native prey, deer, for example, and livestock are common. When you take all of those factors into consideration, what you conclude is, from what we know from decades of work with wolves in the United States, that kind of setting, private lands, lots of livestock, an unknown number of native prey, that's not a landscape for a large carnivore to be reintroduced to restore population accounts to recovery like the Mexican wolf. An easy way to look at it, Megan, the United States Fish and Wildlife Service would never use that kind of landscape in the United States for wolf reintroductions to restore a population that counted to recovery.
So
and
what
yet
would,
they're expecting that landscape in Mexico will work.
What's the suggestion that you and fellow biologists see? I mean, expanding it into Colorado and Utah and other areas, would that be a better option?
We've published that. We've in good journals, we've published the results of our habitat suitability work that takes into account important variables. And Karen can speak to this. Another one of your guests, an important variable is the distribution and abundance of livestock. We've published our results in good science journals, and we said clearly you got to go north where the Mexican wolf is currently being reintroduced in the United States. That's good habitat. That's good habitat. That southern Arizona, southern New Mexico country might support 150, 200 wolves. That's a beautiful contribution. It's not quite enough for recovery, so you have to have at least a second population. We actually believe that a third population would be required as well. But regardless, whether it's a second or a third, the only way you can get a sufficient number of wolves on the ground to honor the spirit and intent of the Endangered Species Act is to go north, at least into the southwestern portion of Colorado.
Sherry, why is that not part of the plan? What are the issues with maybe expanding this into Colorado?
Well, what the Fish and Wildlife Service wanted to do was to first look at that area south of Interstate 40, which pretty much defines what we consider to be the historical range of the Mexican wolf, south into Mexico. The Mexican wolf historically went down to about the state of Oaxaca in Mexico. And so what we wanted to do was to first explore whether recovery is possible down there. Mike's correct that there is not public land in Mexico, and we do have some questions on the abundance of prey. But those are all elements that we're going to be working with over time. And the Mexican government, the federal agencies of CONAMP and SEMARNAT are very good collaborative partners right now. They're very committed to recovery of the Mexican wolf. They have some excellent biologists down there in Mexico who are working on the recovery of the wolf on the ground. They've started reintroducing wolves back into the wild in 2011, because when the Mexican wolf was eliminated from the wild, it was also eliminated from the wild in Mexico. And so we're working with them, seeing what they can, how effective that program will be. And importantly, in the recovery plan, we have evaluation criteria 5 and 10 years to see whether or not this strategy is working or not.
This is Let's Talk New Mexico, and we're talking wolf recovery in the Southwest. How important is it to you that the Mexican gray wolf be recovered in our region? Do you agree we need wolves living in the wild? Why or why not? Call now 1-877-899-5866 or tweet with the hashtag Let's Talk NM. Sherry Barrett with the Fish and Wildlife Service. More than 21 Democratic state lawmakers sent a letter to your regional director, the Southwest, saying this draft plan is politically driven. How has your agency's need to work with the states to get this plan done influenced the content?
Well, it's important to know that under the Endangered Species Act, Section 6 of the Endangered Species Act says that we're going to work to the maximum extent practicable with our state agencies in recovery of Mexican wolves and other endangered and threatened species. And so it's an important part that we include them as partners, not only during the recovery process, but also after a Mexican wolf, for example, is delisted, it becomes the management authority under this state. So that they take over that management of all listed species after they're delisted.
If it's no longer under the Endangered Species Act.
Correct. So Okay. It's important that we work with the state agencies during that process.
And I do want to add again, we did reach out to the New Mexico Game and Fish Department to include them on this show. They did not make anyone available to participate today. But also joining us in the studio is Karen Cowan. She's Executive Director of the New Mexico Cattle Growers Association. Thanks for joining us, Karen.
Thank you for having me.
Karen, many environmentalists do not like this draft recovery plan. Your members don't like it either.
That's correct.
Why?
I guess we have long believed there needed to be a recovery plan, and this is kind of be careful what you ask for. But we don't believe that recovery is possible relying on a foreign country. Politics do come into play every country that you deal with, and we just don't think that it's fair to ranchers in New Mexico and Arizona to have to wait for Mexico to meet their goals before the critter can be delisted.
Sherry, what do you say about those concerns? And Mike, you can chime in too, but if we're relying on Mexico, is that too much uncertainty in this process?
Well, obviously we don't have regulations that – we don't apply regulations in Mexico. They're a sovereign nation. So it's a collaborative process that we have with them. The Fish and Wildlife Service does have what we call a trilateral agreement. That's agreement for cross-border species with Mexico and with Canada. And we meet on an annual basis with them to talk about these various species. So the Mexican wolf is not our only species that we collaborate with Mexico on for recovery. We have sea turtles, ocelots, jaguars, and condors. So other species also fall under that same agreement.
Mike, do you have any thoughts on that?
So, Megan, Karen just brought up a most important point, and it was a point that previous recovery teams considered. I can remember vividly sitting in Albuquerque at a recovery team meeting. This was before Sherry's tenure, where a Mexican official said, we don't want to be involved. And so the point is, a sovereign nation can change its perspective, and yet the way this plan is being offered, Karen's absolutely right. The United States could be, well, held hostage, waiting and waiting for Mexico to deliver on their side of the bargain. That does seem decidedly unfair, given that the United States has no statutory authority in Mexico. We are very much, in this particular case, not in control of our own destiny. You combine that very practical observation by Karen with the very practical observation that the landscape of Mexico is not conducive to the restoration of a large enough population to contribute to recovery, I think this whole thing is going to get stuck. And Sherry made reference to the fact that we can revisit it 5 or 10 years. The way the draft plan is written and will likely be finalized, it then becomes the marker in the sand. And to really do any significant shifting from what it sketches out as the future, you well could imagine yet another recovery planning process in 5 or 10 years. I would remind all of your listeners that it's taken almost 30 years to get a new recovery plan in place to substitute for the one that was signed off on in the 1980s. I will remind all your listeners, I've been on every Mexican Wolf recovery team that's been convened since 1995. That's 22 years trying to develop a new recovery plan. So I find little comfort in knowing that, well, if we find 5 or 10 years from now it's not working in Mexico, we can sort of readjust. It's taken about 30 years to readjust, and I can't imagine that readjusting in 5 or 10 years would be a straightforward process then. It certainly hasn't been a straightforward process so far. And Megan, you ask about politics. It's important that everybody be reminded that back in 2013, the four governors, Utah, Colorado, New Mexico, Arizona, sent a letter highly critical of the Mexican Wolf recovery program and how Sherry was trying to complete the recovery planning process. Sherry had actually sketched out a really solid approach going forward to develop a draft plan, and the governors were keenly critical. In response to that letter, then-Director Dan Ash said unequivocally, we're going south. He did not wait for the best available science to define what constituted good Mexican wolf habitat. He simply said, we're going south. Now, while Section 6, as Sherry made reference to the Endangered Species Act, requires collaboration with the states, a more overarching demand of the Endangered Species Act is that work be based on the best available science. And yet back in 2013, the director short-stopped all of that process by saying, we're going south, before the best available science had been assembled.
We have to take a quick break, so hold on. This is Let's Talk New Mexico. We'll be right back.
The law firm of Rothstein Donatelli is committed to supporting KUNM. Since 1976, the firm has litigated Native American law, criminal defense, wrongful death, and civil rights in New Mexico and nationwide. Info at rothsteinlaw.com.
KUNM program support provided by not-for-profit Presbyterian Healthcare Services, serving New Mexico and building trust for more than 100 years. More information about Presbyterian and the services they provide at phs.org.
In 1915, Manuel de Falla wrote music for a ballet called El Amor Brujo, Love the Sorcerer. It's a classic boy meets girl story, except the girl is haunted by her dead husband. Coming up, the LA Guitar Quartet in concert playing a love story with a ghostly twist on the next Performance Today from APM.
Weekday mornings at 9 on KUNM.
This is Let's Talk New Mexico. I'm Megan Kamrick, and we're talking about the newest plan to recover the endangered Mexican gray wolf. Are you concerned about wolves killing cattle and causing problems for ranchers? Do you fear seeing wolves in the wild? Call now, 277-5866, or email letstalk@kunm.org. Among our guests today are Sherry Barrett with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and Mike Phillips, director of the Turner Endangered Species Fund, as well as Karen Cowan, executive director of the New Mexico Cattle Growers Association. Karen, there are actually a lot of advocates who see this plan as one that's more favorable to ranchers than wolves. but why don't you agree?
For the reasons that I just stated initially. And there's a lot of talk about genetic diversity. Part of the issues with this program at its outset was that they started with seven wolves. And simple animal husbandry tells you that, you know, you're going to breed those, and we have been breeding them for 30, 35 years. But you can't make more new genes out of a small pool like that. So, you know, I don't know how you get more genetic diversity in this plan. We're also concerned about how long it takes. They think that the species might be downlisted under this plan.
Removing it from endangered species protection.
No, okay. That means it's listed as endangered now. I think it would take it, Sherry, down to threatened if it's downlisted.
Correct.
Okay.
And then they're not envisioning recovery until 25 to 35 years. And even at that, they don't talk about delisting. They talk about recovery. And we're looking for something that puts us back in control of our own destinies.
Okay. So tell me if I'm wrong, but you're interested in seeing the recovery of the Mexican gray wolf because then it's not under what ranchers feel might be sort of burdensome federal regulations protecting it. Okay.
Yeah. And I've devoted 25 years of my career to this species, and I'd sure like to see something happen in my lifetime. And with this recovery plan, I don't think that happens.
Well, let me ask you, ranchers have been compensated when wolves killed their livestock. I understand your members don't feel that that's necessarily working well or
well,
is adequate.
Well, it's not true.
Okay.
The Defenders of Wildlife had a program for a while where under a very specific criteria, ranchers could be compensated. There is now a wolf coexistence program going on now. And the funding to it is like $60,000 or something. That is simply not adequate to cover the losses. We have one member that over the last 2 years has lost more than $50,000 worth of cat livestock, and it's probably well more because that was a number from a year ago. And he was compensated $5,000.
And give our readers an idea of, if we don't know ranching, tell us how does that compare to what the market value is?
It's pennies on the dollar. Ranchers only have one payday a year, and that's something that most people wouldn't even be able to live under. That payday is when you wean a calf and you're able to sell it. And if we don't have calves to sell, every time that a calf is eaten, you're taking $500 to $700 with today's market right out of our bank accounts. And, you know, how many people could survive with that happening?
So what do you want to see done differently
in
the plan?
We'd like to see the Mexican part come out. And we'd like to have an opportunity to have some input into this plan. On all recovery teams prior to this one, we have had a representative from the industry, both from Arizona and New Mexico. And this time it was done in a vacuum. And that's a huge concern.
Can you address that concern, Sherry? First, the input, but I want to circle back again to the Mexican part.
Yeah. Do you want to talk about the funding part?
We are going to talk about the Coexistence Council a little bit later in the show with Craig from Defenders of Wildlife. But what about the public input? The cattle growers don't feel their voice was heard, or ranchers don't feel.
Yeah, we worked first with the states, the Forest Service, the Mexican government, and independent scientists, including Mike, on the input parameters for the VORTEX model, the population viability analysis. And then we moved and worked with the states, the Colorado, Utah, New Mexico, and Arizona, and the Forest Service and the Mexican government on the actual development of the draft recovery plan. That all occurred between about February and June of this year. And so what we then intended is for us to be able to obtain that comment from the other stakeholders and interested parties, of which there's many, through that public process, the public comment process.
I did have a question on Mexico. Mike was talking about this before we went to break. He feels strongly about why this is not viable and we should be looking north. But what if we build this large wall along the border? How does that impact wolf recovery?
Well, when we assess these populations, the one in the United States and the one in Mexico, we've also looked at whether or not connectivity is necessary for these two populations to persist. Again, that 90%
So you're talking wolves going over back and forth across the border.
Right. And so the population model shows that they don't need to have that connectivity. But we recognize that they do need to have genetic input. And so there is also that ability for us to simply move wolves between the two countries, which we do right now for breeding purposes and for releases.
Mike, does that answer any of the concerns you raised before we went to break?
Megan, let me jump in real quick. Thank you.
I have to go to a caller in a minute, but go. Give me a quick.
Well, we can. Karen makes some great points about practicality and whether we're in control of our destiny. When you take a real good, detailed look at the plan, not only does it speak to habitat in Mexico that has not been properly assessed. So imagine if you can acknowledge that the only threat that the gray wolf has ever faced is the threat of human-caused mortality due to livestock conflicts. And Karen's right, they're very real. And because of real conflicts, gray wolves have been killed in big numbers. So it's the only threat that exists, really, for the gray wolf. And so in Mexico, in an attempt to assess habitat, the one real threat, which is livestock, was not part of the assessment. There was really no scholarly assessment of the distribution and abundance of livestock in Mexico, and yet we're supposed to have a faith that the habitat model was useful. Sherry has spoken more than once to the vortex model. The vortex speaks about population persistence and how genes are shared. It doesn't say anything about habitat. A whole different model was developed for habitat, and the model that is highlighted in the draft plan did not consider in a proper way the distribution and abundance of livestock. Moreover, to establish the numbers that are required by the draft plan, the numbers of wolves in the wild, it's a significant number of new releases that have to be conducted of Mexican wolves. Specifically, 70 new releases in the United States, 100 new releases in Mexico over an undefined period of time. Those are really, really big numbers in the world of releasing gray wolves. No recovery program has ever achieved that kind of release mass. 170 wolves over the course of some short period of time, if genetic diversity matters, and Karen's right, you don't create more genetic diversity. All you can do is slow the rate of loss. So for these releases to matter, they have to be done over a relatively short period of time. 170 animals, a bunch of puppies, 102 puppies to be specific, and 68 adults, all coming from the captive breeding program that probably cannot provide the number of individuals required. When you take just a practical look at this, Megan, I'm just an old field biologist that looks at this and says, well, gee whiz, could I actually do this? I don't think so.
Okay. This is Let's Talk New Mexico on KUNM. We're talking about wolves and the draft plan issued by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to ensure recovery of Mexican gray wolves. A final plan is due November 30th. Do you have a ranch or a business that has been affected by the wolf recovery program? How can we ensure the coexistence of wolves with other land uses? Call 277-5866. Tag us in a tweet with the hashtag #LetsTalkNM. And on the phone, we have Andres from Rio Arriba County. Andres, thank you for calling.
Yes, how are
you doing? Hey, I'm good. What did you want to talk about? What did you want to ask?
Well, of course, what the topic's about, and not being a rancher or siding for ranchers, or also like the other guy there, your guest, pretty pro. Bringing back, the wolf. My question is, how fast do they duplicate or multiply, and how much do they consume on a daily basis? Because if we're going to set them up for failure, then that's not doing them any justice or anyone.
Okay.
And then, one more thing. Uh-huh. By our climbing, the weather changes more and more, even though some deny the global warming. Is there going to be enough food for them to eat without having to go on livestock, or maybe even attack a child in the wilderness, or who knows, or somebody who's camping or whatever? And that kind of question.
Okay.
So I'm kind of neutral, but those things need to be addressed. Thank you.
Okay, Sherry, you wanted to answer that.
Well, first to address the safety issue, Mexican wolves are a wild animal, and you always have to have caution around any wild animal. But the risk of any attacks on humans is extremely low over time, and no Mexican wolves have ever attacked anybody. There have been a couple of gray wolf issues in the recent history, but that's it. But so be aware that just the risk of a human attack is very low. And under the Endangered Species Act, even though it's an endangered species, people always have the right to defend themselves against an attack or the lives of others. So with regard to food, over 80% of the diet of Mexican wolves is elk. And so there's an abundance of elk in Arizona and New Mexico in this area south of I-40. And neither state agency, state game agency in either Arizona or New Mexico have documented any effect of wolves on those elk populations. Certainly individual elk are eaten, or they're killed and eaten, but as a population, they have not been affected.
And what about, and you or Mike could answer this, isn't there a diversionary feeding program idea in the plan?
What is that? Yeah, and that's part of our management right now. We have a process where during the time that the wolves are denning, we have a program where we use diversionary feeding, and that's just if those that den happens to be near a herd of livestock, that we do provide some their carnivore logs, or if we have roadkill elk, we'll use that as well to divert those wolves from livestock depredations. So we have used that as well.
And Mike, is that usually successful in diverting from livestock?
I'm sorry.
Oh, the diversionary feeding programs.
Yeah. So Megan, the listeners should pay sharp attention to that. So here we have this great big wild landscape of the Southwest. And in order for Mexican wolves to fit in, this is in the United States now, and Sherry made reference to the abundance of elk. That's true. There are no elk in Mexico. Mm-hmm. That's a principal problem. But even in the abundance of all these elk, the southwestern landscape is so well-defined by livestock that Mexican wolves have to be fed. The United States Fish and Wildlife Service has been doing this for many, many years, this diversionary feeding. I would be very interested in seeing how does the population in the United States persist if that feeding was stopped. There may be so many conflicts that you could really say, oh, gee whiz, this habitat's not as good as we thought it was going into this whole thing, because absent this feeding program, the wolves are stuck into all kinds of problems. In Mexico, the feeding program is even more robust. In Mexico, the Mexican wolves aren't just fed during the pup, the whelping and the pup rearing season. They're pretty much fed 365 days a year. The program is applied. They're not fed every day, but food is put out all four seasons, and it's all done to minimize the potential for wolves in Mexico to have conflicts with livestock. That says something fundamentally important about the quality of habitat. Now,
okay,
you could say to Karen and her team, you got to change the way you handle your livestock, or you could say to the United States Fish and Wildlife Service, you're expecting something of this southwestern U.S. landscape and northern Mexico landscape that it simply cannot provide.
Okay. I'm going to go to a caller. Casey in Albuquerque has a question about the cost of the recovery program. Are you there, Casey?
Yes.
Go ahead.
I was just wondering how they plan to pay for all this with that large number of wolves in a habitat that really can't support them.
Okay. Sherry?
Well, Mike is right. You can't expect to have this diversionary feeding over time. We'll have, as the population grows, we have more tools that we can use. The cost is something that we understand in the draft recovery plan seemed high, but it needs to be recognized that that cost included the cost of the breeding facilities that provide funding and manage and care for those wolves pro bono. So that's not a federal tax or state tax revenue that's used for that. But it is actually we have 51 different facilities that are breeding wolves.
Mm-hmm.
And
for reintroduction.
Correct.
Mm-hmm.
And those costs were in that overall cost for the recovery of the wolf. And those are, like I said, it's pro bono.
Mm-hmm.
But the answer to the question,
yes,
is in the recovery plan, the projected cost is over $263 million.
Mm-hmm.
And
okay,
that's the cost that I was saying included those pro bono facilities. So we also have funding that addresses the depredations compensation that is coming through grants to states and tribes, which I know we're going to talk about later.
Okay. One more caller, Alicia from Albuquerque. What is your question this morning?
Yes. I'd like to ask about hybridization. Since genetic diversity is such an issue, how are they going to keep wolves from crossbreeding in the wild?
Hmm.
Well, so far, we have not had any wolves that have hybridized, Mexican wolves that have hybridized with coyotes. That has not occurred. We've had three incidences where they have hybridized with a dog, and we have had to euthanize the puppies in all three of those instances. And otherwise, the wolves in the wild are behaving as wolves.
Why is euthanizing? Sorry, I couldn't get the word out. Is that necessary?
It's necessary to maintain the integrity of the wolf population because it is a pure Mexican wolf that's out there in the wild, and we need to make sure that's how it remains.
I do want to jump into, we've been talking about coexistence and animal depredation. So joining us is Craig Miller with Defenders of Wildlife. The group helped create an organization that was the Coexistence Council. Now it's the Mexican Wolf Livestock Coexistence Council. Craig, what is that and how does it work to bring together wolf advocates and ranchers and tribal governments?
Yeah, so in 2011, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Regional Director convened a diverse group of stakeholders, including ranchers who'd been living in the presence of wolves for a number of years, and county representatives and tribal representatives, and a few conservationists who'd been involved in either conflict avoidance or compensation, to put our minds together and come up with, you know, the best possible plan, a fair and balanced approach, if there was such a thing, to address concerns related to a growing wolf population and the potential impact that wolves can have on livestock operations. And over the years, we evaluated virtually every compensation and incentive-type program across the globe, and we believe that we selected the best components of each plan and combined them into something that was appropriate for the Southwest.
And you've
been managing that program. Go ahead.
Oh, go ahead. So, and this was this part of also, tell me, the Range Riders program you guys have? Is that part of the same idea? If you could talk about that.
Yeah, it's been sort of a harmonic convergence of multiple initiatives over the years. As Karen had mentioned earlier, my organization, Defenders of Wildlife, managed a livestock compensation program. I managed it for the first 12 years of the program in the Southwest. And there were some inadequacies of that program. We tried to make it flexible. But the fact of the matter is, you know, post-mortem compensation means you're basically paying for dead livestock, and in many cases you're also have dead wolves and disappointed conservation community and disappointed ranchers, and it just wasn't achieving the level of tolerance that we desired for a compensation program or that was necessary to facilitate recovery. Back then we became more interested in helping to prevent conflicts from occurring by working further upstream in partnership with ranchers in wolf-occupied areas to adopt livestock husbandry practices and management tools and techniques to reduce the vulnerability of livestock to wolves in the form of range riders or hiring sons and daughters or neighbors of ranchers to increase monitoring of calves during calving season, which also coincides with denning season when most depredations occur, or using diversionary feeding or supplemental feeding to relocate cattle away from den sites or help wolves stay located in areas where there are fewer opportunities for conflict, or using fladry and fencing configurations to try to reduce wolf-livestock interactions, et cetera. That was a program that was an outgrowth of our compensation program, and we've been continuing that for a decade or so now. With the Livestock Loss Demonstration Project, which was a federal program as part of the Omnibus Public Lands Management Act, it created a federal program for livestock compensation. It creates a funding mechanism for the states and tribes to develop their own conflict avoidance and compensation programs. The Mexican Wolf Livestock Council was assembled in part to help develop pilot program that could be supported by that federal fund or could use that federal funding to benefit southwestern states, livestock producers in wolf country.
We're going to talk just a bit more about this. We just have to go to a quick break. This is Let's Talk New Mexico. We'll be right back.
Cars can stand for a whole lot more than just a way to get somewhere. They're our first taste of independence. They carry lots of memories. Even after we can't drive anymore, we may hold on to them as a way of, holding on. So when you decide to donate your car to KUNM, we know what a special gift you're giving. We are truly honored that you chose us. To donate your car, call 888-KUNM-CAR. That's 888-586-6227.
Deserts in the Southwest are hotter and drier. Many link it to climate change. And it's only going to get worse, according to a 2013 National Climate Assessment. For tribes in the Southwest, that could mean shortage of water and economic loss in livestock and agriculture. We'll take a look at all of this on the next Native America Calling.
Weekday mornings at 11 on KUNM.
This is Let's Talk New Mexico. I'm Megan Kamrick, and we're talking about the federal plan for recovering the Mexican gray wolf. Federal officials are reviewing thousands of comments on the plan, and a final version is due November 30th. How would you like to see adversaries working together on the issues of wolves in the Southwest? Why should we consider supporting ranching as well as introducing more wolves to our ecosystem? Call 277-5866 or email letstalk@kunm.org. We just heard from Craig Miller from Defenders of Wildlife. So, Craig, has this proven more effective, this program you were talking about, the Coexistence Council and the Range Rider and these other efforts at protecting wolves and livestock?
Yeah, it's more effective by several metrics. One, for ranchers who work in collaboration with either us or with the state or federal agencies, they've noticed a significant reduction in losses. In fact, in the 15 Range Rider projects that we sponsored this last summer, we had no verified losses occur in those situations. So it's a difference between night and day. And I want to point out that there's been an evolution in the program. You know, we started off with just a postmortem compensation, but today there's a diversity of programs available to assist ranchers who are interested or willing to try management practices to reduce conflicts. There's support, financial support for conflict avoidance, both through Defenders and through the Mexican Wolf Fund and through the Mexican Wolf Livestock Council. There are a variety of livestock compensation options. One of those is a federal program called the Livestock Indemnity Program, which is part of the Farm Bill administered by the Farm Services Agency. The other is called the Livestock Loss Demonstration Project, which supports funding to states and tribes and to the Mexican Wolf Livestock Council, which supports both conflict avoidance and compensation. And in Arizona, they've got a new livestock loss board, which is comprised primarily of ranchers and state officials to address very specific situations related to depredation. There's no reason that couldn't be replicated in New Mexico. These are all outgrowths of at least an initial attempt to address, you know, the primary concern expressed by ranchers going into the wolf recovery program. That's the potential economic impact that wolves can have. Now, beyond compensation and conflict avoidance, there are also programs available to help incentivize or create rewards or benefits in the presence of wolves. And one of those is a performance-based incentive payment program operated by the Mexican Wolf Livestock Council called our Coexistence Program. And the Coexistence Program is intended to support three shared goals: healthy western landscapes, self-sustaining wolf populations, and viable ranching. And it issues an annual payment to ranchers who enroll in the program who live in wolf-occupied areas, either in a wolf territory or a core use area. And it is a payment based on a point system. If ranchers adopt conflict avoidance measures through the use of range riders, et cetera, they're eligible for a multiplier for the payment. Payments are based on whether or not the type of operation a producer has, a cow-calf or yearling operation, and most importantly, from my perspective, the number of pups that survive to the end of the year. So it's performance-based in that it pays out and rewards success at attempts at conflict reduction and cooperation towards helping to increase the wild population of wolves.
Well,
also recognizes. Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Oh no, go ahead. I'm sorry. Finish your thought.
The final thing is, you know, one of the major criticisms of a compensation program, Defenders and others, is that it requires some kind of verification. You know, livestock can die for a variety of reasons, from shipping fever to digestive ailments to calving complications and predator depredation. So to be fair, we did require that there be confirmation that, you know, livestock were lost to wolves before compensation payments were made. The beauty of this new program is that it doesn't require third-party compensation. It's an up, it's a payment that is made regardless of whether livestock are died or not. It's intended to acknowledge that there are costs associated for producers operating in wolf country that may or may not be verifiable. And so every rancher who's enrolled in the program receives a minimum payment equal to the value of a calf, market value of a calf that year, on up to, I think the payments range from, you know, $1,500 to $25,000 in within the last couple of years.
I just wanted to add in Sisto Hernandez, since we're talking about this. He's the chairman of the Mexican Wolf Livestock Council and also the range management specialist with the White Mountain Apache Tribe. Are you there, Sisto?
Yes, I'm here. How are you this morning?
Good. How are you? Thanks for joining us.
You bet.
Well, what are the challenges? You've been listening to Craig talk about this program that you're involved in. What are the challenges that your tribe and community has faced in balancing these different needs of multiple land uses and reintroducing wolves?
Well, first, I'd like to thank Craig for explaining our coexistence program with the Mexican Wolf Livestock Council. I think you did a great job. And as for your question, the challenges we face on the reservation aren't much different than the challenges that are encountered nationwide. I mean, we have many of our tribal members that are livestock owners that are active in ranching. We have many of our tribal members that are outdoorsmen and hunters, and not just hunt for sport, but hunt to provide for their families. And it's, I guess it's just fair to say that what we experience here, at least on my reservation, I don't know if I want to speak for all reservations because we all have a little different perspective on things, but for my reservation, it's not the, I don't know, the Disney picture that it seems to get painted out there a lot of the times, that we do have differing opinions that amongst the members of my tribe, that there are different values represented there. And
so you have some people who really want the wolf versus other people really having trouble with them.
Oh, yeah. I mean, mm-hmm. It runs the gambit of that, of those individuals that are extremely opposed, those individuals that are very much pro, and those in between that are like, oh, there are wolves here? You know.
So how has the Coexistence Council, the Mexican Wolf Livestock Council, addressed some of these issues in your mind?
It's been helpful because I think something that many people lose track of is when they think of ranching, when they think of agriculture in general, they think of maybe the Midwest, maybe the Great Plains, where there's significantly less land needed to support a ranching operation, as opposed to here in the arid West, where ranches are huge compared to the land areas elsewhere in the country, even in the northern plains. And when you're needing confirmation for each individual animal out there that may be affected, it's almost impossible. And then throw on top of that our arid climate here in the West. Even when you do, you may find a carcass. It may have been there for a while, and there's no way of determining what really happened a lot of the time. So, but that being said, many ranchers, if not most ranchers, have experienced increased loss during the reintroduction of these wolves. Even if it's, I mean, we may know that we're losing more. We may know that we're not as able to support our families. We may know that it gets a little harder, but it's difficult to document that. And so with the council's approach, with the program we've put together, it helps to address that. Like Craig said, on the wolf advocate side, yeah, it takes into account not just the presence of wolves, but also how many pups survived, the success on the recovery side. But also, it takes a lot of the it takes some responsibility off the rancher for having to so diligently document every incident that may happen on a large ranch, on a 20, 40, 60,000 acre ranch. And that way, it's not perfect. Certainly, it's not perfect, but I think that it's been one of the best efforts made. And if what we've put together can also help make the can be a framework that either the Arizona Livestock Loss Board or even a comparable board in New Mexico comes up with, then that's great. We're happy to contribute to those guys. And we're just trying to find something different. Like Craig said, something that's not reactive, something that's before there are dead calves on the ground, before there are wolves having to be removed, something to help address issues before that has to take place.
And I know, Sisto Hernandez, that recently there was a wolf removed from the White Mountain Apache Reservation because of some cattle deaths. I don't know if you can address that. It's because there was a string of deaths. So what happens? You call in the Fish and Wildlife Service? Or maybe I should ask Sherry how that works.
Well, I wasn't part of that removal. And I know that there has to be a serious amount of documentation before any action like that is taken. And I think Sherry might be might have more information on what led up to that action.
Can you say something briefly, Sherry, about how that works? So basically, the wolf has to be removed and euthanized, right?
So what happens, when we have first we try and do proactive measures, right? We try and do the range riders and other programs to avoid any depredations from occurring. Once the depredations may start, we also increase our management on the ground from our interagency field team that manages the wolves in the wild. And they'll start with, for example, hazing cracker shells and other...
What is that?
Noises.
Oh, okay.
Flashing, mm-hmm. lights, or we use rubber bullets even just to something that's non-lethal to try and dissuade the wolves from being in an area of livestock. And then, like I said, the actions escalate then to if we can't manage and control a chronic situation, then at times a wolf does need to be removed.
I wanted to bring Karen back in with the Cattle Growers Association. Been listening to this idea of the coexistence council and these other ways of compensating ranchers. Your thoughts?
It may help some people, but basically our members don't raise livestock to feed wolves.
You don't? I'm sorry, say that again?
We don't raise livestock to feed wolves.
Okay.
So the idea that you're being paid for wolf presence but losing livestock is one that doesn't sit well with many of our members.
Does it address the issues Sisto is saying, having to confirm the kills, which seems like really challenging in these giant ranches?
That is a huge problem. And we had one instance this summer where a ranch manager took a photograph of a wolf carrying a calf's head. And it's just kind of no-brainer. But he was that member was only compensated as if it was a probable loss because they didn't know the photo wasn't time and date stamped and the calf might have been stillborn. So that's the level that people have to go to try to get compensation. I mean, a wolf has a calf's head in its mouth. That ought to be a confirmed kill.
Well, I there's so much more to talk about, but just quickly, Sherry, give us an idea of what happens now with the plan.
Well, with the plan right now, we're going through the comments, the peer review comments, and we'll have a final in November. And can I just say one thing? I want to, there's a picture painted that wolf conservation recovery is dire and failing, but I don't think that's true. We started from zero in the wild in the United States and Mexico, started with seven wolves, bred them, and we now have wolves that are functioning as wolves in the wild.
Okay, that's all the time we have. Thank you, everyone who joined us today. Thanks to my guests, Sherry Barrett, Mike Phillips, Karen Cowan, Craig Miller, Sisto Hernandez. You can continue the conversation on Twitter with the hashtag #LetsTalkNM. We have more links and resources at KUNM.org. Our engineer is Marino Spencer. Sarah Trujillo and Victor Onimole screened your calls and live tweeted the show. Elaine Baumgartel is our executive producer. Join us next Thursday at 8 for Let's Talk New Mexico.